Good morning. We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session March 1st, 2012, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Black Beauty Coal Company, docket number late 2008-477. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, and Commissioner Nakamura. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. Morning, Rory.
Good morning. In this civil penalty proceeding, Administrative Law Judge Margaret Miller upheld a citation in two orders issued to Black Beauty Coal Company for alleged failures to provide sufficient protection against over-travel at three discrete areas of a surface mine, the Somerville Central Mine. The judge affirmed the designations of the three enforcement actions as significant and substantial violations and affirmed that they were attributable to the operators and warrantful failure to comply with the cited standards. The judge ordered payment of the assessed penalty of $16,543. Black Beauty petitioned the commission for review of the judge's decision with regard to the citation in the two orders. The commission granted the operator's petition for review. I will now summarize the background and the party's arguments as to the first citation. On September 11, 2007, MSHA inspector Vernon Stumbo inspected a bench measuring about 180 feet to 200 feet wide and elevated approximately 50 feet above the pit floor. A drag line located on the bench was being used to remove a layer of rock or inner burden so that the deepest seam of coal could be accessed. During the day of the inspection, Black Beauty was in the process of moving the drag line across the bench to a new location. Black Beauty had lowered the berms to provide sufficient room for the drag line and its boom to maneuver. On this occasion, the drag line stopped mid-move because of electrical issues. A service truck traveled to the drag line to perform maintenance while it was idled. While on the bench, Stumbo observed the service truck and tire tracks, which indicated that the truck had traveled within 18 feet of the edge of the bench. Stumbo observed that while berms were present in part of the dragline bench, which also converts to a fall road or travel road, on another part of the bench, he observed zero berms. As a result of his observation, Stumbo issued citation number 6671134. The citation alleged a violation of the mandatory standard in section 77-1605K, which requires berms or guards to be provided on the outer bank of elevated roadways. The judge determined that the operator violated the safety standard. She concluded that once rubber-tired equipment begins operating on the bench, especially with close proximity to the edge, the bench becomes a roadway. She further concluded that a reasonably prudent person familiar with the facts would have recognized the safety standard required the bench to contain a berm that was at least mid-axle height of the service truck. She found that the operator's truck traveled over an area of the bench that contained an inadequate remnant berm. In addition, the judge concluded the violation was significant, substantial, and attributable to the operator's unwarrantable failure to comply with the site standard. Black Beauty asserts the judge erred by finding the bench constituted a roadway and is required to comply with the safety standard. It states the bench does not fall within the definition of a roadway. The operator contends that a roadway commonly involves vehicle travel during the normal mining routine. The secretary agrees. The secretary contends, however, that the testimony of Black Beauty's own witnesses compels the conclusion that the bench was a roadway within the meaning of Section 77-1605K. Black Beauty also contends that the judge's factual finding regarding the adequacy of the berm lacked the support of substantial evidence because her conclusions are inconsistent with the testimony of the inspector. The secretary acknowledges that the judge's conclusions are confusing, but asserts that her intended meaning is discernible when the language is read in the context of Stumbo's citation and testimony. Black Beauty also asserts that the judge erred in finding that the violation was significant and substantial and attributable to an unwarrantable failure. The secretary states that the violation was significant and substantial and attributable to the operator's unwarrantable failure.
Thank you, Rory. Commissioner Cohen, I believe, has agreed to lead off the discussion this morning.
As I understand it, at this point we're just discussing the first file.
Yes, that's right.
I want to thank Rory for a comprehensive and thoughtful decisional memo, which was particularly excellent on the S&S issue. The first question with regard to citation number 6671134 is whether, as the secretary alleged and the judge found, the bench where the drag line was operating was a roadway pursuant to 30 CFR section 77.1605K. I think it was. Black Beauty bases its argument on a contention that commission precedent clearly establishes that whether a location is a roadway which requires berms under section 77.1605K depends on the common usage during the normal mining routine. I don't think that commission precedent is at all clear on this issue. One of the cases cited by Black Beauty, Capital Aggregates, uses the common usage phrase, while another case, Burgess Mining and Construction, uses the normal mining routine phrase. However, in both cases, the phrases are used descriptively rather than as a legal requirement for a roadway. Nevertheless, it would be reasonable for the Commission to now interpret the word roadway as including the ideas of common usage and normal mining routine. During oral argument, counsel for Black Beauty acknowledged that the bench was a roadway during normal mining, but it argued that the bench ceased to be a roadway when the drag line was moved. I think that this is a problematic approach, having an area of mining changing its character like this, especially when we understand that the drag line will break down and require repairs from time to time. I don't think that I agree with the proposition that a single rubber-tired vehicle on a bench automatically converts the bench into a roadway. But we don't have to go that far to affirm the judge's conclusion that this particular bench was a roadway. The facts here are that the drag line was moving every 7 to 10 days, which is certainly a normal mining routine. It's undeniable that breakdowns occurred, and that when those breakdowns occurred, it was necessary for Black Beauty to bring in rubber-tired trucks so that repairs could be made. This represents a common usage during the normal mining routine. I also note that Black Beauty's position that adequate berms remained even during the time that the drag line was being moved. This suggests that Black Beauty does not believe that it has any real problems maintaining adequate berms during the drag line. Even though I consider the bench a roadway under the regulation, I have problems affirming the judge's finding of a violation. Inspector Stumbo testified that there were no berms for a distance of 0.2 miles. This may be the distance from the MSHA vehicle to the drag line, but that's not clear. Unfortunately, the Secretary's trial counsel did not ask Mr. Stumbo to identify where the 0.2 mile was located. Black Beauty's witness, Mr. Traylor, testified that a remnant berm existed along the bench from the MSHA vehicle to the drag line. In her decision, the judge seemingly tried to bridge the gap between Mr. Stumbo's testimony and Mr. Traylor's testimony. She said that the parties did not dispute that a remnant berm existed for 0.2 mile. However, this is not correct. Mr. Stumbo's testimony was that no berm existed. The judge said that Mr. Stumbo testified that while a remnant berm existed on the part of the bench that the service truck had driven on, no berms existed on other parts. This is also inconsistent with Mr. Stumbo's testimony because he said nothing about a remnant berm. At this point, and pending consideration of the views of my fellow commissioners, I am inclined to vacate the judge's decision on this violation and remand it for reconsideration. I recognize that one might argue that the judge credited Mr. Stumbo's testimony and that Mr. Stumbo testified that there was no berm. Based on this, consideration could be given to simply saying that substantial evidence supported the judge's ultimate conclusion of the violation. But I'm troubled by that kind of approach. For one thing, the Secretary's brief invites us to, quote, discern the judge's intended meaning, unquote. I question whether the Commission should engage in such an exercise. If we get into discerning judges' intended meaning, it is an invitation to rewrite what the judges actually say, and we shouldn't be doing that. For another thing, the judge did not consider Mr. Traylor's testimony of a remnant berm which was above 16 to 17 inches in height. The Secretary argues that the redirect testimony of Mr. Traylor, that the remnant berm was at least half the height of the service truck tire, was inconsistent with his previous testimony. I don't agree with that. We know from Mr. Stumbo's measurement that the mid-axle height of the service truck was 21 inches. Mr. Traylor's direct testimony of above 16 to 17 inches is not necessarily inconsistent with his testimony on redirect. I note in this context that if there was an inconsistent Secretary's trial counsel could have cross-examined Mr. Traylor, but did not do so. The judge did not make a determination that the testimony of Mr. Traylor about the remnant berm was not credible. At least as of right now, I'm reluctant to conclude that the judge's finding for a violation should be affirmed. The burden of proof is on the secretary to prove the violation. If there's a gap in the secretary's proof, it could be concluded that she failed to carry her burden. I am inclined to remand so that the judge can reconsider the record rather than to engage in an attempt to discern the judge's intended meaning. Since I think the violation issue should be remanded, I'm not going to address the S&S and unwarrantable failure issues in the citation.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Next, Commissioner Nakamura.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I would also thank Rory for a comprehensive memo and also for putting up with me coming into your office and asking you lots of questions about it. So thanks very much, Rory. I would also find that the bench in this case and under these facts is a roadway for purposes of Section 1605K. I agree with Commissioner Cohen that our case law is not as clear as the operator would suggest it is or argues that it is. I do think our case law supports the view that whether a travel way or a bench in this case is a roadway does depend on it, on the specific facts and circumstances in the case at hand. As Commissioner Cohen indicated at oral argument, the operator did state that and concede that the bench is a roadway prior to the moving movement of the drag line and after the drag line is moved, and takes the position because I guess there are rubber tire vehicles that are used for hauling. And I'm assuming that the maintenance and service trucks also travel that road to do maintenance on the drag line. So I think the operator argues, I guess, during the time that the drag line is being moved, it ceases at that time to be a roadway. I wasn't able to find any cases to support that proposition, but I think in this particular case, you have to look at the fact that the service truck came was sent out on the bench to do this, I guess, welding work in the context of the fact that this is a roadway before and after. The drag line is moved. And what the testimony was that by the, I think it was the drag line manager, that the reason this service truck was sent out to do the welding was because the drag line experienced an electrical problem and it was down. I guess it couldn't be moved. I think the DM described it as it was stopped mid-move. And the operations manager said, oh, well, if the drag line goes down during the move, then we'll send the service truck to do something like welding. I think he said welding the bucket or other welding that needed to be done. To me, this means that if there hadn't been the problem, then that particular service truck would have been sent out either before or after the move, and not during the move. It was only sent out there, according to testimony, because the drag line was down and couldn't be moved. And it just seems odd to me that if the welding was done before and after the move, that the truck, the driver, and any passenger would enjoy the benefits of the protections of 1605K with the berms. But But if it occurred that the drag line goes down during the move, and then they go out and do the maintenance, that they don't enjoy the benefits and protections of 1605K. And if you buy into the operator's argument, that's no longer a roadway. So I find that to be an odd result. And for that reason, and based on these circumstances, I would find in this circumstance that it was a roadway and it remained a roadway when that service truck was sent out to do the welding. Now, on the judge's finding of violation, I also agree with Commissioner Cohen. It seems to me that, based on the evidence, the judge was faced with two options, either finding that there was no berm or finding that there was an adequate remnant berm. And she actually chose door number three, which was an inadequate remnant berm. And as Commissioner Cohen alluded to, I guess there was some testimony by Mr. Traylor. I can't remember his title, but I guess before the break, he said that the remnant berm was somewhere around 16 or 17 inches. I was a little fuzzy on that, and you know, maybe don't hold it to that. And then after the break, he came in and said it was at least mid-axle height, which would have been 21 inches. And if you were going to say that the berm was remnant berm was there and inadequate, you would have had to, I guess, credit Mr. Traylor's pre-break testimony and discredit his after-break testimony. But the judge didn't do either of those. She credited Mr. Stumbo's testimony. And that testimony was that there was no berm at all. So I just find that confusing. And based on that, I would vacate the finding of a violation and send it back to the judge for clarification on the violation issue. And because I would vacate on violation, I would not reach the SNS or vulnerable failure issues.
Thank you, Commissioner
Nakamura. Commissioner Duffy? Thank you, Madam Chairman. With respect to citation number 6671134, alleging a violation of section 7560.5K, the lack of adequate berms in the bench during the move of the drag line, I would reverse the judge on the grounds that the standard is not applicable to the circumstances presented. I base my conclusion on the fact that the bench was not a roadway when production was suspended during the drag line move, because normal vehicular traffic, for example, the operation of haulage trucks, was not taking place in that area during the relevant time. And because the use of the bench by the single service truck during the relative period did not constitute, quote, normal mining routine, close quote, as that term has been used in prior commission cases, to determine when 75-1605K applies. As a result of that threshold determination, I don't find it necessary to address the judge's conclusions relating to significant, substantial, and unwarranted failure. I would note, however, that if the commission were to conclude that 75-1605K is applicable in these circumstances, I would have fundamental questions regarding the judge's rationales for finding the violation to be unwarrantable or as met. In any event, assuming the applicability of the standard, the judge's apparent misapprehension of the facts surrounding this particular alleged violation makes it difficult to provide adequate review of the conclusions relating to the fact of violation and the special findings. And in summary, I would reverse the judge in making the citation.
Thank you, Commissioner Duffy. Commissioner
Young? I agree with Commissioner Duffy. I would reverse it. I'd like to add a couple additional things. First of all, we need to remember what we're trying to do here. And Commissioner Nakamura has noted that the miners riding the work truck would not have enjoyed the protection that the standard that troubles them. I don't think the protection of the standard made any difference to them at all, because I think the judge is conclusion that these miners or anybody else was driving in close proximity to the edge is unsupportable and illogical. 18 feet is, for a worker pickup truck, is a huge distance. It's wider than an interstate lane of travel. It's wider than a lot of two-lane roads. For somebody to believe that he's in danger of going off the edge in a relatively small vehicle, and that's an important point I'll get to in a minute, it doesn't square with the facts of this situation at all. And that's where I get to Commissioner Cohen's point about the changing character of the mine site. And Commissioner McNamara brought this up also, that if it's a road before and a road after, then it has to be a road during. And that's just not the case. There is literally a huge difference in the operations. And the huge difference arises from the fact that the haulage trucks used are gigantic. And 18 feet would be close proximity for one of those trucks with their massive 10 or 12 foot tie. The fact is, it's more difficult to see the environment, to control where you're going, to account for things around you in one of those trucks. The berms provide an important protective standard in that event. They're absolutely necessary, and the mine is configured and designed to facilitate their travel when the road is configured as a roadway. However, when the drag line is being moved, there's one purpose with the drag line, that it tears up the entire bench. In order to move the drag line, they have to reduce the berms. They can't get the berm, they can't get the boom through there without doing so. Therefore, by necessity, the character of the roadway must change because its use changes. It is not being used or intended to be used as a travel way. The fact that a truck might travel on an area doesn't mean that becomes a road. There's a reason you use these four-wheel drive vehicles and large trucks with off-road capabilities, because you might have to drive off-road. And in this case, all of the evidence suggests that this was a deeply rutted, wide expanse of land with no exposure to any miner, to any danger of over-travel. The only people that might be in danger of over-travel here would be Thelma and Louise. You would have to volitionally drive off the edge of this bench. And you'd have to do it at a much slower rate of speed, and it would be very difficult even under those circumstances because of the rutting of the roadway. This presumes not only mere inattention or carelessness or recklessness on the part of the drivers, who have every incentive, remember, to try to protect their own lives from danger here. It imposes unconsciousness. I don't see any possibility that a miner would be exposed to any reasonable hazard in this circumstance. And the purpose of the berm standard is to protect miners from these hazards. There's no evidence at all in the record that anyone under these circumstances was exposed to any hazard. So I would join Commissioner Duffy in vacating and reversing the judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I would also like to thank Rory for your decisional memorandum and also for your willingness to spend a lot of time going over the records and discussing the exhibits with me and debating the issues. The question of whether this area is a road, upon further reflection in this matter, I started to think that the way that we address this, what's the proper way to address this? As a reviewing body, is it our call to decide whether this is a road or not, under our analysis of what makes sense or what doesn't make sense? Listening to my colleagues' considerations on, weighing the pros and cons, the extent of the traffic, the ruts in the road, the distance from the edge, These may all be valid and important considerations to take into effect. But yesterday evening, and continuing to think about this case, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the various aspects, I realized that the regulation in question requires berms on elevated roadways. And the secretary has decided to apply this regulation in this situation and has indicated that she will apply this regulation in her view that the existence of rubber-tired traffic on an area, she will consider it a road. I went back and looked at some cases, and I'm mindful of the fact that my role is to consider whether the secretary's approach, and she is allowed to take an approach, a litigation approach, and indicate her position on a regulation in litigation. And here, it appears to me her position is, if an area requires the traversing of a rubber-tied vehicle, she will consider it a road and require berms. I'm now thinking that my role is to consider whether that interpretation, that application of the reg in such a situation is a permissible one. And in that, you know, while we may have views about what is the best way and whether this makes sense or not, in the end, the Court of Appeals has said that the courts occasionally defer to permissible regulatory interpretations that diverge significantly from what a first-time reader of the regulations might conclude was the best interpretation of their language, and that they may defer where the agency's reading of the statute would not be obvious to the most astute reader, and even where the petitioner advances a more plausible reading of the regulations than that offered by the agency. It's the agency's choice that receives substantial deference. And so here, you know, in the end, I was thinking to myself, well, all right, there's not much traffic during this particular mining procedure, the moving of the drag line, but there is occasion to have some vehicle traffic on the road, particularly this one service truck. Is that truck, if there would be more trucks traveling on this same road, would they not get protection? Apparently, yes, some commissioners have decided it's the extent of the traffic, but still, the wideness of this area wouldn't change. So if it's so wide and so protected and not needing the berms, you know, for the one truck, there's two or three trucks that are going at a time, would that change? Is not the one driver entitled to the protection of the berm? There's a significant drop off on this road here. We're talking about a 50-foot drop. And like Commissioner Nakamura has pointed out, the area in question is considered a road direct, you know, immediately prior to the move of the drag line. Berms are put in place. The area is a haulage road directly after the move of the drag line. Berms are reinstalled in place. And it is during this particular time of the move that's in question whether it's a road or not. And the operator has conceded that it needs to lower the berms during the time of the drag line move, but they could be lowered and still comply with the berm requirements, and they could. There's also some evidence that the drag line moves so slowly that the berms, it's really not much of a problem for them to reinstall the berms as to keep up with the drag line. So there's a lot of factors that come into play, and actually, I think, though, that perhaps the correct analytical framework is to consider whether the Secretary's application of the requirement in this type of situation is a permissible application of the Secretary's regulation, which uses the term roadway. So I would uphold the application of the reg to this situation and consider, agree that the secretary is reasonable in applying it here as a road. I would also affirm the judge's finding of a violation. I don't think that there is confusion. There are some misstatements by the judge about whether there was agreement as to remnant berm or agreement, you know, or, but the bottom line is the inspector's citation was issued because it stated the dragline bench travel road does not have a berm for a distance of approximately 0.2 miles. The secretary then, when the citation was challenged, put on evidence to that same effect. The inspector testified that there was areas where there was no berm. And the judge then, in her opinion, she referred to Black Beauty's position that there were adequate berms present, if that was Black Beauty's position, but she said she credited Dumbo's testimony and finds that for approximately 0.2 miles on the bench roadway, there were inadequate berms. So I think my role is to consider that did the judge's finding of a violation, is that finding supported by substantial evidence? Given the fact that there was evidence presented to the judge, the citation said no berm for 0.2 miles, the secretary presented testimony to that effect, she credited the secretary's witness. I feel that that is substantial evidence to support the judge's determination, and the confusing, you know, references do not detract from that. On the question of whether the violation, the judge found the violation, she upheld the determination that the violation was significant and substantial. I'm inclined at this point to affirm that, although I'm still considering that. I do think that the fact that the judge found that the lack of a berm, the testimony was that there was no berm for 0.2, that 0.2 miles without a berm, or even an inadequate berm, is a significant distance where the vehicle would be traveling by. The drop-off is quite steep. There are the factors that have come into play, as my colleagues have mentioned, there's not that much travel, but right now I would be inclined to affirm the significant substantial finding. The finding of unwarrantable failure to this violation, I would vacate and remand that for the reason that I would ask the judge to consider the potential mitigating fact of the operator's contention that it did not consider this to be a road that required compliance with the berm requirement during the move of the drag line. I feel that while the secretary's construction and application of the regulation may be permissible, it may not be, as the GE court pointed out, the first thing that comes to one's mind, you know, the construction that one might be aware of or think of. And here, although the operator had been cited the prior week for lack of berms and had received berm citations, I don't think that those citations would have really alerted the operator to this particular issue. I think that they received a prior citation for not having berms on the dragline bench, but I believe that the testimony and the argument during oral argument is that that was in an area where they conceded they needed to have berms. I think that was when it was back to being a haulage road after the dragline move. So I would want the judge to at least consider, in determining whether this violation was a result of an unlawful failure to comply, I think that although the secretary may be allowed to apply the regulation in this kind of situation, that the operator's contention of whether that it viewed this as not needing berms should be taken into account in the determination of whether the violation is unlawful failure.
Thank you. On September 11, 2007, Stumble also visited a newly built travel road connecting the number 6 bench to the upper level. It was constructed to transport a cat-mounted drill rig. The road was approximately 110 to 120 feet in length, inclined at a 30% grade. A wall was located to the right of the road. The opposite side of the road was exposed, with a 50-foot drop from the edge of the road to the bench below. Stubble observed that the road lacked berms for about 75 feet. Stubble also observed tire tracks in the road, which were left by a truck driven by the drill foreman. As a result of his observations, Stumbo issued order number 667-1135, alleging an additional violation of Section 77-1605K. The judge concluded that while adequate berms may have existed at the bottom of the road, inadequate berms existed for part of the drill road. She credited Stumbo's testimony, specifically his description of the side of the travel road. In addition, the judge concluded the violation was significant and substantial and attributable to the operator's unwarrantable failure to comply with the site standard. Black Beauty contends that the judge's conclusion regarding the adequacy of the berms lacks the support of substantial evidence. The operator asserts that Stumbo's description of the side of the road on cross-examination contradicts his description of the area on direct examination. The secretary responds that Black Beauty's arguments lack merit, for Stumbo's testimony was not contradictory. The secretary maintains that a violation of the CITES standard was established because part of the drill road did not contain a berm. Black Beauty also asserts that the judge erred when she found that the order was properly designated as SNS. The secretary agrees that the judge erred in affirming the SNS designation in the order. The secretary argues the judge erred because she was required to assume that an incident of over-travel was reasonably likely to occur when she evaluated whether the order was SNS. Black Beauty contends that the judge erred by finding the violative condition was the result of an unwarrantable failure to comply with the site safety standards. The secretary argues the judge correctly decided the violation was the result of an unwarrantable failure.
Thank you, Rory. We'll go in the same order as we did on the first violation. Commissioner Cohen, can you read off?
With regard to the railroad violation, order number 667-1135, I would affirm the judge's finding of a violation. I think substantial evidence supports the judge's finding that part of the road lacked a berm. Mr. Stumbo testified that part of the road had a berm, but that a 75-foot section of the road lacked an adequate berm, and the judge credited this testimony. The judge's credibility determination is reasonable, and the testimony she credited represents clear substantial evidence of a violation. I turn now to the SNS issue in the drill road violation, and I want to approach this issue in two separate ways. The first way is by reference to the decisional memorandum, which in my view sets out a very clear and accurate description of the four-prong Matthews test in light of the Commission's decisions in the PBS, Musser, and the Cumberland Coal cases. As the decisional memo states, the Commission made clear in these cases that under Matthews, the Secretary does not need to prove a reasonable likelihood that the violation itself will cause an injury. In this case, both the operator and the Secretary, both in her brief and in oral argument, have articulated the test as whether there is a reasonable likelihood that the violation will cause an injury. This is an incorrect statement of law. Once a violation is found, Matthews requires, in its second prong, that the judge identify a hazard and determine whether the particular violation contributes to that hazard. Then, in the third prong, the judge determines whether the identified hazard is reasonably likely to cause injury, and then the fourth prong, whether that injury will be serious. Except for its last paragraph, I agree with the DM's analysis of the S&S issue. As to the second prong, the judge stated, quote, I find that the violation contributes to the danger of a vehicle veering off the elevated roadway and rolling or falling down the spoil incline. This is a correct finding under the second prong of Matthews. The judge noted in her analysis of the violation that an inadequate berm or no berm at all existed for a significant portion of the drill road. She credited Mr. Stumbo's description of the side of part of the road as, quote, horizontal, straight out, unquote. This constitutes substantial evidence that the violation contributes to the hazard of going off the road. The judge further concluded, quote, if a truck traveling along an inadequately bermed elevated roadway experienced mechanical failure or user error, and were to go over the edge and fall the estimated 50 feet to the surface below, it is reasonably likely that anyone in the vehicle would sustain injuries of serious and potentially fatal nature. This is a finding which supports both the third and fourth prongs of the Matthews test. The judge took the hazard identified in the second prong and determined that this hazard was reasonably likely cause serious injury. As the decisional memo stated, the judge's conclusions satisfy the second, third, and fourth prongs of the Matthews test. The only problem I have with the DM is the last paragraph of its S&S analysis. The DM had noted that it was error for the judge to include Mr. Eleno's explanation of his conduct in driving down the drill road in her S&S analysis. The DM stated that this discussion related to negligence, not S&S. I agree with that. But I think that this was harmless error. As the DM concluded, in light of the rest of the judge's analysis, the second, third, and fourth prongs of Matthews were satisfied. The judge's discussion of Eleno's negligence does not change this. Thus, I see no need to remand the case for redetermination of S&S without consideration of Eleno's testimony. The second way that I want to address the S&S issue is by reference to the oral argument last week. At the oral argument, Black Beauty's counsel argued that the secretary must prove a reasonable likelihood that somebody was going to go over the edge of the berm. Counsel made clear his view that S&S requires proof that it is reasonably likely that the injury-causing event will actually occur. The Commission explicitly rejected this test in UBS Mustard and Cumberland Cove. I recognize that Black Beauty's counsel is appealing our decision in Cumberland Cove to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and so we'll certainly maintain the position that he's taken in Cumberland in this case. If he wins there, then we may have to rethink our formulation. But for now, at least, the Commission law is that the second and third prongs of Matthews contain separate tests with separate quantum of proof required. Reasonable likelihood in the third prong, but not in the second prong. And that it is not necessary to prove a reasonable likelihood that the violation itself will cause injury. Indeed, if this were the case, it would be hard to distinguish S&S from imminent danger. At the oral argument, the Secretary's counsel acknowledged that Cumberland Cove, which had not been issued at the time counsel wrote his brief, was very enlightening and redirected the Matthews analysis. Thus, the Secretary did not explicitly offer the assumption formulation she made in her brief. However, I believe that the Secretary still does not understand the explanation of Matthews, which the Commission set forth in PBS Mustard and in Cumberland Cove. The Secretary of Oral Argument formulated the third prong analysis in this case as, quote, in the event that the driver loses control of the vehicle, is it reasonably likely that the vehicle is going to go over the edge, unquote. Thus, the secretary continues to make the same mistake that the operator makes, requiring proof of a reasonable likelihood that the violation itself will cause the injury-producing event. Secretary also misformulates the issue here under the second prong of Matthews by describing the hazard in terms of the driver losing control. Thus, the secretary is continuing to rely on analysis based on assumption. The secretary ignores the judge's formulation of the issue under the second prong, whether the violation contributes to the hazard of the truck going over the edge, which is the correct formulation of the issue. The hazard is going over the edge. This is not dependent on the driver losing control of the vehicle. The question under prong two is whether the violation, here the missing berm, contributes to this hazard. If you focus on the driver losing control, the whole question under the second prong falls apart because the absence or inadequacy of berms has nothing to do with the driver losing control of the vehicle. Thus, you cannot analyze whether the violation contributes to the hazard. This is an extended discussion, and I'm not doing it to upbraid the secretary. Rather, it is a predicate to discussing the concerns raised by my colleagues, Commissioner Duffy and Commissioner Young, at the oral argument. Both commissioners raised serious and legitimate concerns at the oral argument. Unfortunately, I believe that the responses by the secretary did not address these concerns, and so I will attempt to do so here. Commissioner Duffy focused on the difference between a lifeline required by the Minor Act as part of an emergency response plan, the issue in Cumberland Coal, and the berms in this case. I agree with Commissioner Duffy that the purpose of a berm is not limited to the situation where a truck is in the process of going off the road, but rather includes the function of a guardrail on a highway, serving as a guide. I would suggest, however, that the fact that a berm's purpose is broader than use in an emergency does not really change the analysis under prong two of Matthews. Commissioner Young articulated the concern, and I'm sure that Commissioner Duffy agrees on this, that under this reading of Matthews, every violation of a safety standard will be S&S. Quote Commissioner Young, quote, at some point, are we not at risk of assuming too much and assuming that every circumstance is going to be significant and substantial where you have a high degree of danger, unquote. I think that this is a very valid question, but I disagree with the Secretary's answer to it. I think the answer lies in understanding the nature of the Matthews prong to analysis. First, the judge must identify the hazard. A hazard is an event or condition which places minors at risk, such as the over-traveling of a berm. Then the judge must evaluate whether the particular violation in the case contributes to that hazard. This is a fact-driven analysis. It is not just absence of berm equals hazard. The judge must look at the particular berm in question and determine whether it contributes to a hazard. We addressed this in Cumberland Coal when we noted that an insignificant lifeline violation may not contribute to the hazard of minors being impeded in their escape in the event of an emergency. Applied to the present case, I would suggest that not all inadequate berms contribute to the hazard of a vehicle going over the edge. It may be that the gap in the berm or other degree of inadequacy is such that it does not actually contribute to the hazard. Or it may be that no trucks travel the roadway. I don't want to hypothesize all of the possible fact patterns where an inadequate berm does or does not contribute to a hazard. That's for a law review article, not a decision based on particular facts by this commission. For purposes of this case, I think it is sufficient to conclude that while a violation of Section 77.1605K may not in some cases contribute to the hazard of a truck going off an elevated roadway, in this case, substantial evidence, that is, the flat horizontal side of a large portion of the grill road that the judge found does support the judge's finding under prong two of Matthews. We can leave other hypothetical instances of inadequate berms to another day, at which time the commission's judges will find the facts and apply the law. And if a party disputes what the judge did, the commission can review the case at that time. I apologize here if I misquoted either Commissioner Young or Commissioner Duffy. I tried to take it as close as to the transcript as I could, but I felt the need to address what you all said, because I thought there were very significant concerns that were not addressed by the Secretary. As to the judge's finding of an unwarrantable failure, the judge relied on Black Beauty being on notice because of prior violations for inadequate berms. I think that this is a valid finding, and I reject the arguments by Black Beauty that it is not. But the judge also stated that she questioned whether the road was really temporary because Black Beauty did not block the road and Mr. Leno used it as a shortcut. I think that this is speculative. Black Beauty's evidence was that the road had been built shortly before the inspection to get a drill rig up, that after the holes were drilled, they would be filled with explosives and shot, and that this would then obliterate the road. This process would happen quickly. And perhaps the judge disbelieved this evidence, but if so, I think she has to explain why she disbelieved it. The reason she gave did not do so. I'm also troubled by Black Beauty's argument that Mr. Leno's reasonably believed that the road was adequately burned. He entered the road at the top, where the berm was unquestionably adequate. When he started down the road, did he know that the berm was inadequate near the bottom? Should he have turned around when he realized or should have realized that the berm was inadequate and gone back up the road? I'm not suggesting that the judge's unwarrantable failure determination be vacated because she failed to check off an item or two on a checklist of factors. Rather, I think that it should be vacated because, first, the judge engaged in speculation that the road was not temporary rather than addressing the evidence that it was temporary, and two, the judge rested her determination partly on the conduct of Mr. Leno without considering whether that conduct might have had a reasonable good faith basis that the road was adequately burned. I think that these factors should be reconsidered and weighed together with the judge. The judge is justified finding that Black Beauty was on notice that it had a problem with the berms because of the two prior violations.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Commissioner McNamara?
Yes. I would also affirm the violation. The judge did credit the inspector's testimony about the lack of an adequate berm along the drill rig road, and also credited the picture as described by the inspector. And I think that there's substantial evidence supports the finding of violation based on her crediting Mr. Stumbo. With respect to S&S, I was initially inclined to either request additional briefs on the issue or remand the case back so that the parties could ask the judge to reassess S&S in light of the PBS case and the Cumberland. But based on the particular facts in this case, I'm inclined to go ahead and affirm the S&S. I think the absence of a berm on a substantial portion of this 125-foot road with a 50% grade and a 50-foot drop-off does substantially contribute to the hazard of driving off the edge, which creates at least reasonable likelihood of a serious injury. I know there was some testimony about the double berm and this sort of dip in the road, but that second berm was already off the road. And in a portion where there wasn't the dip, I think the testimony was that you go off the second berm and over the edge. And if you went into the ditch, the dip, I mean, there's certainly, I think, a reasonable likelihood that you would suffer injuries and possibly serious injuries as well. So that's not persuasive, and I would find affirm the S&S finding on the 66-7135 order. I agree with Commissioner Cohen on the unwarrantable failure, particularly with respect to the first error he described, and that was the judge's comment that, in her view, the road might not be temporary. And it seems to me that's a pretty big factor if she really believed that the road was not temporary and was going to have some permanence to it and last for beyond the 1 to 3 days, I think the testimony reflected. That if this was going to be a semi-permanent road, then certainly there'd be greater dangers, a greater danger that of injury and going off the road by not only the supervisor, because I think the supervisor, Mr. Alano, was actually the person who authorized building of the road or requested that it be built, so that, you know, all was, you could probably at least infer, as she did, that others in his crew would follow suit. And that would be important if this road were going to last a long time. But I think that Deanne's correct that all the evidence suggests, and Mr. Stumbo agreed, that this road was probably going to be destroyed within the next few days. So I would vacate the finding of unwarrantable failure and send that back to the judge for reassessment.
Thank you. Commissioner Duffy?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'd like to also thank Lord for his analysis of this case. With respect to order number 667-1135, alleging a violation of 75-1605A, the lack of a berm on a temporary ramp connecting the number 6 bench to the upper level. Include substantial evidence supports the judge's conclusion that a violation existed. However, I don't believe her analysis adequately supports either a finding of significant, substantial, or unwarrantable failure. As for S&S, the analysis is somewhat muddled and includes what I consider extraneous characterizations of the drill foreman's conduct that may be relevant to the degree of negligence surrounding the violation, but not to the level of seriousness. The record does not give a clear indication as to how wide the ramp was in comparison to the vehicle driven by the drill foreman, the key finding and determining a substantial contribution to the hazard of overdrive. With regard to the unwarrantable failure finding, I believe it was incumbent upon the judge to consider each of the five elements set forth by the Commission in Consolidation Coal Company. It acknowledged that the judge may stress some factors over others or find that some factors are not relevant to the circumstances arising from the violation. Nevertheless, all factors must be addressed, and this the judge did not do. For example, the judge did not sufficiently weigh the fact that the ramp was temporary. Indeed, was likely to be destroyed by blasting that was scheduled to be commenced once drilling was completed. That key factor goes to both the length time the violation went unabated, and whether the violation posed a high degree of danger. In sum, I would remand this issue back to the judge for more thorough analysis of the special findings in conformance with the Commission precedent.
Thank you. Commissioner
Rory, I also fail to acknowledge your important, very insightful decisional memo, the great job you did marshaling the evidence for what I found to be a very logical and well thought out analysis that was very helpful to me grappling with this case. On this violation, I would affirm the fact of violation just because I believe it's supported by substantial evidence. On the S&S, I very much appreciate Commissioner Collins' consideration of my views, which I believe you accurately quoted. I did have a concern that we do, in fact, following this formulation, assume too much. When we look at the unwarrantable failure analysis that would result from that, I believe, and if I mischaracterize this, I do apologize, but it's been stated that the danger, the hazard rather, is that someone will go off the road.
Excuse me, I just said the record's clear. Is this in regard to unwarrantable analysis or S&S?
No, this is the S&S.
Okay, I thought so, because you said unwarrantable.
I'm sorry. If I misspoke, I apologize. I'm talking about the S&S here. The hazard is that someone will go off the road. And in viewing the hazard thusly, in effect, we codify Murphy's Law. You assume someone will go off the road. And if you posit the analysis that way and say that the violation creates a hazard that someone will go off the road, and any time there's a serious injury that would result from that hazard coming into play, you're going to have an unwarrantable failure. I don't see any way around that. It seems to me to be the mirror fallacy to the one that we addressed in the Cumberland case, which was that you would never have you will never have a significant and substantial violation, because it's always objectively highly unlikely that there's going to be a minor emergency. The fact is, we're dealing in Cumberland with a special set of circumstances in which the mine environment, as a general matter, is changed in the configuration and activity in the mine shifts from the production of coal and the management of that activity, or the production of another mineral and the management of that activity, to the need to safely and efficiently evacuate the miners and protect them from the dangers arising in an emergency context. I maintain in Cumberland, I didn't participate in the case involving the Key Creek mine, the PBS case, that I maintained in the Cumberland case, that we should consider reasonable likelihood as context sensitive, i.e., it's never going to mean more likely than not that something will occur, but rather that we should consider whether the circumstances and the facts of the situation indicate that this is the type of hazard that, due to the danger involved and the relative likelihood that danger would threaten the miners who might be exposed to the hazard, it should be considered significant and substantial. Significant and substantial is an important triage tool. And if we get to the point where everything is significant and substantial, then nothing is. It's useless as a tool, because you can't prioritize if you're left at the whim of whether an inspector deems something to be significant and substantial, because he's identified a hazard and the danger is correct. If you look at a guarding violation and say there's a guard missing, and obviously, if the danger is, or the hazard is, somebody sticking his arm in the guard, and that's the end of the analysis, of course, if you're dealing with a crushing or cutting piece of machinery, it's going to be significant and substantial, because he's going to lose his arm. So I really have some concerns that we, in refining this analysis on S&S, if we determine to do so in this case, that we get it correct. And I would agree with Commissioner Cohen that the Secretary doesn't have it correctly. I have to give Mr. Waldman some credit, because I had to go back and reread the cases, because he really made a very interesting argument for the application of the standard as he saw it, but I don't believe that's the correct standard. So I think that I would remand on the S&S for the reasons that primarily the Commissioner Duffy cites, but also because I think that to the extent facts come into play, the facts and the configuration and the location of where this absence of berms are may be important in determining whether this was a significant substantial violation. That's the judge's job and not mine, just so this is just dicta purely, but it seems to me that the greatest danger of over-travel or going off the road would be down in the dip there, where you have a change in both the curve and a change in elevation, and that would seem to be a problem. It looked to me from the evidence that there was a redundant form of protection there from the most serious injuries. But as Commissioner Nakamura noted, even going down in the dip in the truck, there's a possibility of overturning. All these are things that have to be considered by the judge. Largely they were, but we have to make sure that the analysis is correct, and I would agree with the DM's conclusion that considering Mr. Alana's conduct shouldn't have factored into that and may have altered the analysis. On the unwardable failure, I would agree with Commissioner Duffy on this generally, and I share the concerns that Commissioner Nakamura and Commissioner Cohen have as to how this conduct is viewed. It's important in this event also to consider where the absence of berms were. Mr. Alano had begun travel on the road and it was properly bermed. He may not have noticed the areas where it was improperly bermed, and it may not have reflected a willful disregard or a reckless degree of lack of care on his part to have driven on the road in that condition. I don't believe that the judge's decision takes that into account or makes it clear. It just seems to assume that because the road was inadequately burned, him driving on it as a supervisor was something that showed a high degree of indifference. I don't believe that the record really necessarily reflects that. So I would consider a lot of the other factors in terms of the S&S in some. Including the configuration of where this was and taking into account the duration and the exposure, the way the road is going to be used, the types of vehicles that might be traveling at what speed, and trying to figure out whether minors were exposed to the hazard and placed at risk in a way that created a significant and substantial violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Actually, need to clarify. Commissioner Duffy, were you going to vacate the SNS finding
in the last? SNS in the morning, I would vacate for finding there in the morning.
Okay, so bring in for the now. Okay. I'm not sure I'm going to have a clear count at the end of the meeting. We're probably going to have to. Some things may be kind of fluid. On the drill road violation, I would affirm the judge's finding of the violation. Again, I think there was substantial evidence in the record to support a finding of a violation of the berm requirement. The inspector testified as to his observations and that the condition of the berm was not adequate to meet the necessary height. And I also agree that the material that the operator contended was an adequate berm was not on the road, it was off the road, and the judge could correctly conclude with the inspector's testimony that did not meet the berm requirement. As to the S&S violation, the S&S determination, I would affirm the judge's finding on that. I think there is substantial evidence to find, to uphold the judge's determination that the violation was S&S. The lack of berms extended for 75 feet of this road. The road was only 110 feet. I mean, it basically, almost the entire drill road lacked the necessary berms. As some of my colleagues have indicated, the drop-off is significant here. I think it was a 50-foot drop-off again, and also the road had a grade of 30 or 40%. You know, these are factors that the inspector noted as going into his determination that the violation was S&S. At this point, I listened with interest, listened to my colleague's comments on the appropriate S&S analysis, and I think that to the extent that we can clarify and offer more guidance to the parties and the judges as to how to apply the S&S requirement in the statute, what is appropriate, that is a good thing, and in this case, we may be able to do that. I think if we can't provide more clarity, I may not be able to, but I think that, as Commissioner Cohen has mentioned, the PBS case in Cumberland have set forth some different kinds of analysis. Whether they, and how much guidance they provide for us here, I'm actually engaged in thinking that through and intend to have additional discussions with my colleagues and hope that maybe we can provide some more guidance. On the question of the unwarrantable failure, I would affirm the judge's finding in that regard in this violation. The fact that the judge may have speculated whether the road was temporary or not, I don't see that as depriving their determination of substantial evidence. I mean, substantial evidence is enough evidence that a person could reasonably draw the conclusion that the judge drew. Here, the judge was influenced by the fact in determining whether the violation was the result of a warrantable failure. The judge did take into account the fact that this operator had been cited for lack of berms, two citations, just the week before. And I think that the fact, you know, whether the road would have been there more time or less time, in this particular matter, I'm not sure that it's a pertinent consideration in the unwarrantable failure analysis, because it seemed clear from the evidence the operator considered they were not in the process or had no intention of putting more berms on the road. They were maintaining that the material that was pushed, you know, that was off the side of the road and created a sort of a trough, if you went over the edge, was in fact an adequate berm. I agree with my colleague, Commissioner Nakamura. Still, looking at the exhibit and the photograph, it was off the road. It really didn't, seem reasonable that they would consider that an adequate berm, and that you would still possibly topple over, but, you know, going off the road into this trough, maybe you wouldn't go down the side 50-foot drop as easily. But I think that the considerations that the judge took into effect in the unwarrantable are not fatally, there is no fatal defect in her considering whether the growth is really temporary or not. I also feel that the behavior of the particular driver, Mr. Alano, I appreciate what my colleagues are saying about his behavior, whether he entered the road, whether he thought there were berms, adequate berms when he entered it. But in determining, I don't think the unwarrantable failure determination is necessarily based on the state of mind of Mr. Alano or his behavior, or whether he particularly thought there were berms or not. When you have virtually the entire road without berms on a significant, with a significant drop off, I think that, and you have been previously cited the week before for lack of berms, that those conditions, those considerations come into play in the warrantable failure and the particular negligence of Mr. Alano. Whether he considered that there was enough berm there when he entered the road or not, did not substantial evidence in my mind. Did I want to go there? So I think that on that violation.
I just had a comment on the S&S and the second violation. Given that Cumberland is pending review by the D.C. Circuit, in light of particular Commissioner McMurray's comments about the possibility that the first berm, the inadequate berm, actually possibly creating a hazard of tipping over if you were to go over that berm and then being trapped or injured in the ditch against the supplemental berm. I hadn't thought about that, but while we're looking at a road here where by the inspector's credited testimony that doesn't seem to have been reviewed, more than half of it didn't have berms that were deemed adequate. Maybe that we could look at this really as a traditional S&S analysis type case. Note that we reject the expansion or the assumption of the injury producing event, but defer that issue. I'm open to considering that. I'm not saying that I am changing my mind, but if that's something that people wanted to discuss, I'm open to considering and being persuaded on the S&S.
Thank you.
Can I respond to that? Commissioner Young, I just want to pick up on the phrase the assumption of an injury. That's the Secretary's formulation.
Correct.
It's not mine.
No, I said if we make a note, drop a note projecting that approach by the Secretary and moving forward with the more traditional S&S, and just note that in this case, look at all these factors. We find substantial evidence that supports the judge's conclusion and not reformulate Mackey's at this time when we may be given marching orders from the D.C. Circuit on how we ought to consider this issue in the future. I'm not suggesting that they would expand it, but to the extent they do, I'd rather not lay down another new precedent that's going to go up there and trip over the other one on the way back. Or possibly be followed here and then have to be undone.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your comment. I think that I know I certainly intend also to have additional discussions, one-on-one with colleagues and think more about the S&S formulation. But I agree that here it may well fit into the freedom of just traditional SNS formulation.
I agree with it.
Yeah.
That's why I was opening my mouth with saying that I thought initially of remanding it or asking for additional briefs, but I thought it would be decided.
I would also consider that as well. I don't have nearly as big a problem with the SNS in this particular issue as I do on the first for example, of course, first mile violation, so that's that limit. But I'm not sure just where we go. I mean, I see a clear distinction between the situation as well as the context where you have to assume mind functions more standard. Situation here. And I want to revisit my own mind, the PBS decision as well. The PBS decision, the PBS situation is distinguishable from this one to the extent that in the PBS, the wall was breached, the water came in, the miners were put into the game. Here you don't have that situation, you have a little bit more speculation. So you have to start looking at what are the circumstances surrounding the black burns in this particular bench, at this particular time, at this particular factor, and so forth. If you don't have that extra kind of goodness, consideration, which is the occurrence of the injury due to the hazard.
Yeah, I think some of those, I was trying, you know, thinking through and reading PBS, and I agree that there's aspects of PBS in the sense that an inaccurate map, in that case, and I suspect maybe in many cases, you don't even, the discovery of the violation, the inaccurate map is almost made simultaneously or after the feared event has occurred, the influx of water. Before that, you might not know you had the inaccurate map, as I think was the case there. And so the idea of trying to figure likelihood of something occurring, I think, is not as much the source of discussion and analysis in that case. However, I do have shared the concerns of some of the concerns Commissioner Cohen has mentioned that, and I think Commissioner Young has noted this too. If you have to determine a likelihood of an event occurring or making an SNS determination, that's not always clear how one does that and whether that's feasible, and maybe it's moving it almost, as Commissioner Cohen had said, in many cases, towards an imminent danger situation. But I think that there's a lot of area for potential discussions, an attempt to see if, you know, things can be clarified. I mean, the fact of whether a violation just makes a contribution to a hazard, and, you know, looking at that, the language of the statute talks about a significant contribution. So how this all works with the cases that are issued and the one up on appeal, I know I'll be giving it some additional thought. Anybody else want to ignore that? Okay. With that, we can move on to the third violation. You want to summarize that for us, Ron?
Sure. On September 27, 2007, Stubbo returned to the mine and inspected the dump site. He observed an area of the site that lacked the protection of a berm, as well as an area that contained a berm which he considered to be inadequate. At the time of Stubbo's inspection, there was not a miner acting as a spotter at the dump site. Stubbo halted a truck that was in the process of backing up. As a result of his observation, Stubbo issued order number 6671177, alleging a violation of Section 77-1605K. On November 23, 2009, prior to the hearing, the Secretary filed a motion to to amend the petition and to plead in the alternative that Black Beauty violated the safety standard in Section 77-1605L. The standard provides that berms, bumper blocks, safety hooks, or similar means shall be provided to prevent over-travel and overturning at dumping locations. Black Beauty filed a motion in opposition, alleging that the amendment of the order would be prejudicial. The judge did not rule on the secretary's motion before the hearing or at the hearing. In her decision, she stated that Black Beauty was not prejudiced by the amendment or alternative pleading and granted the motion to amend. She noted that administrative pleadings are liberally construed and easily amended as long as adequate notice is provided and there is no prejudice to the opposing party. She then only addressed the alternative violation of Section 77-1605L. The judge concluded that an area of the dump site entirely lacked berms and that the berms in a separate area of the dump site were inadequate. The judge also concluded that a truck was attempting to dump without the assistance of a spotter. As a result, she held the operator's dump site did not comply with requirements of Section 77-1605L. In addition, the judge concluded the violation was significant, substantial, and attributable to the operator's unwarrantable failure to comply with the site standard. Black Beauty contends that the judge erred as a matter of law when she granted the secretary's motion to amend because Section 104A of the Mine Act requires contemplation of only a single standard for each enforcement action. The secretary contends that the judge did not abuse her discretion in permitting the secretary to plead in the alternative, because doing so here had no effect on the operator's ability to either abate the cited condition or to prepare its defense. Black Beauty argues that the judge's conclusion lacks support of substantial evidence. In particular, Black Beauty argues that the record demonstrates that the dump site contains adequate berms, and that the record does not contain evidence to support the judge's conclusion that a truck was dumping without a spotter. The secretary states violation of Section 77-1605L was established because the dump site had no over-travel protection. Black Beauty also asserts that the judge erred when she found that the order was properly designated as S&S. The secretary argues that any error by the judge was harmless. Black Beauty asserts that the judge erred when she concluded that the violation was attributable to an unwarrantable failure. The secretary disagrees.
First off, I don't think that the judge abused her discretion in allowing the secretary to amend order number 6671177 to indicate a different section of the regulation. The order specifically alleged the conduct, which MSHA considered to be in violation. Black Beauty was fully on notice of what it had to do to defend against the factual allegations and what it had to do to abate, and indeed did abate successfully. I don't think that Section 104A of the Mine Act was violated by the judge's grant on the secretary's motion. I would affirm the judge's finding of a violation. The judge credited Inspector Stumbo's testimony that there was no berm in one area of the dump site, the area where he stopped the truck from dumping its load, as well as inadequate berms in other areas. The inadequate berm was 45 inches in height, while the mid-axle height of the haul truck, Stevens got that wrong, I'm not sure offhand. The inadequate berm was lower than the 45-inch mid-axle height of the haul truck. The fact that Mr. Stumbo had to stop a truck from dumping while no spotter was present is substantial evidence of the violation. I would also affirm the judge's S&S finding as this violation. As with the previous violation, the judge's identification of the hazard, which was the danger of a vehicle veering off the elevated dump site and rolling or falling down the spoil incline, that was the judge's definition, is correct. The other part of the Matthews prong two analysis, that the violation contributes to this hazard, is supported by substantial evidence. Then the judge found that if a truck were to travel off the edge and drop more than 100 vertical feet, it would likely lead to the death of the driver. And this conclusion complies with the third and fourth prongs of Matthews. I'm not going to go into the analysis of how you figure S and S. It would be repetitive of what we did in the second violation we discussed there. As to unwarrantable failure, I believe the judge was correct in finding that Black Beauty was on notice about the berm violation. The problem I have with their analysis is that she did not come to grips with Black Beauty's evidence of mitigating circumstances. Black Beauty's evidence was that the dozer operator at the dump site, Mr. Miller, served as a spotter for the dump trucks when Mr. Miller was called away to build a berm elsewhere on September 27, 2007. The supervisor instructed the trucks to hold up and not to dump their loads, or at least his testimony was that he instructed the trucks to hold up. If the supervisor did indeed instruct the truck drivers not to dump their loads while the spotter was away, this would not affect the finding of a violation. However, I can see it as mitigating the circumstance, indicating the dumping which Mr. Stumbo halted was not authorized by the operator's supervisors. Thus, the conduct could be seen as negligent but less than aggravated. Hence, while affirming the judge on the violation and the S&S issue, I would remand on the unwarranted failure issue.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Commissioner Nakamura?
I actually echo Commissioner Cohen's analysis on all counts on this violation. I would affirm the judge granted the motion to amend. I think the record supports that the operator knew of which conditions needed to be abated, and that the operator was adequately able to prepare for the hearing. So the judge did not abuse her discretion. That's the standard that has to be overcome by the operator. Did not do that. I would affirm the violation. Again, there's substantial evidence from Inspector Stumbo's testimony that there was no berm in one area. In fact, the picture is pretty clear. There's two gentlemen standing on the edge, close to the edge. You can see no berm. Certainly inadequate berms in other areas. I think Commissioner Cohen had it right that the first time the axle, that axle height was actually was the 66 inches. And the berm was, I think, 45 inches or lower. Certainly there's substantial evidence that there was no spotter at the time. That's certainly conceded by Mr. Miller's testimony. And although it's disputed, there's certainly substantial evidence to support the judge's finding that there was a truck preparing to dump its load. As far as S&S, as with the second violation, I think under a traditional analysis, I would affirm the judge's S&S finding. Again, the lack of a berm at the dumping site with I think it was 110 to 129 foot drop off, 40% grade, would substantially contribute to the hazard of driving over the edge, especially in a dumping situation. They are close to the edge. And there would be a reasonable likelihood of the driver suffering serious injuries. So I would affirm the S&S finding. For the same reasons as set forth by Commissioner Cohen, I would vacate the unwarrantable failure finding. I think the DEM suggested that it could be inferred by the judge's findings that she rejected the testimony that the drivers were told to hold up. But I think that's an important mitigating factor that needs to be addressed by the judge, to be fair to the operator. And if certainly that directive was given, then I don't know if this would be a maverick driver or what happened in this situation is a mitigating factor. With respect to the unwarrantable failure finding, so I would vacate.
Thank you. I agree with my colleague that the judge did not abuse her discretion in allowing the operator to amend the violation, the citation to indicate it. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a long
meeting. I'm so sorry. As regards order number 667-1177, alleged violation 1605L, the lack of berms, bumper box, safety hooks, and other similar means at the dumping location, I would affirm the judge's conclusion that the standard was violated and that the violation was evidence in nature. I would remand, remand the unwarrantable failure issue back to the judge for the same reason that I would remand on the prior order the failure to follow the commission's analytical method set forth in our consolidation of coal companies. In particular, the judge failed to adequately address the extent of the violation and the full implications of the relatively brief period of time violation existed, and the other mitigating factors referred to by Commissioners Coleman and McNamara. On the issue of whether the judge erred in allowing the Secretary to amend the pleading and argue an alternative theory of violation, I find that the operator was not prejudiced by the amendment, and the amendment was therefore allowable. However, I feel strongly that such a ruling should be made at the beginning of the hearing rather than as an afterthought. While it may be harmless error in this instance, I can see cases where it would be truly harmful, for example, in pro se cases. The fundamental fairness dictates that the judge and the party all agree at the outset on what the ground rules are and what issues are in contention.
I agree with my colleagues on affirming the violation and the S&S and remanding on the unwarrantable for reasons stated on the amendment issue. I appreciate Commissioner Duffy's concerns on that, and I'm open to noting that as a concern in some contexts. I do believe there are cases, however, and we've seen cases where as the case unfolds, demonstration is made that an issue has been presented in a different way than what was pled, and has been tried by the parties with knowledge that that's what they're actually dealing with. And anything we do, to the extent we say anything about the amendment process in this case, I think should acknowledge that there needs to at least be some flexibility in some situations for the Secretary to amend the case, and I think our cases have pointed that out and made that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, as I said a minute ago, I agree with the view of my colleagues. The judge did not abuse her discretion in allowing the amendment of the citation. There was no prejudice to the operator, and in fact, the operator knew what the condition was that was at issue. And in fact, the cite to a different standard, I think it was pointed out in the record of the arguments, allowed even more flexibility with how one would abate that condition under the amended standard. I think there is substantial evidence to support the finding of violation here. The photo, the exhibit, if one look at that, you realize the lack of the berm here was very evident. The judge's finding of significant substantial, I would also affirm here. Again, one look at that photo and you realize the gap in the berm, and you see the drop off there, which I believe in this case was 100 at one point in the pertinent area was 110 feet and 129 feet. Severe drop-off if somebody were to go over the edge. And the idea of, you know, a truck attempting to dump near there with no spotter is just highly dangerous. I mean, I think under any SMS formulation, frankly. So I would affirm the SMS finding. On the unwarrantable failure finding, I believe I would affirm the judge as having enough evidence, significant evidence, to support the unwarrantable finding. Here again, the judge was weighing heavily the fact that the operator week before had gotten cited for lack of berms, and in fact had gotten cited in a dumping situation. I mean, it was saying, you know, it was a dumping situation and a failure to have berms. It's such a highly dangerous situation here that I think that the judge is justified in and there's substantial evidence to support a finding of unwarrantable failure. The judge, I'm not sure what would be required of the judge on remand. I think that she acknowledged, maybe not as extensively and in the right places of her decision, but she clearly, it'd be one thing if I felt she had ignored or not taken into account at all the company's contention that they had attempted to stop the further dumping of the trucks. She referenced that in the decision, so I believe that, you know, she was aware of that claim. And she just, you know, the other factors outweighed it. Unlike, I might point out, my colleague, Commissioner Duffy, I don't believe, and I think we need to guard against, commentary in our other decisions regarding factors that can be taken into account by a judge in assessing whether a violation is caused by the unwarrantable failure. They can become this kind of automatic, rigid checklist that, in some cases, really makes no sense. For instance, to say that we would remand this case for this judge to consider the extensiveness of the violation, that she didn't consider, you know, that particular factor. Well, since she found unwarrantable failure, presumably you'd be remanding to say, look at the extent, look how this is not very extensive. I mean, look, that this might be a mitigating situation. I mean, you wouldn't remand to have her look at evidence that would further support the finding of unwarrantable failure. Presumably. So you'd look, you know, you'd remand it, you'd say, you'd have to have some indication, I think, the commission, in our minds, that there would be something about the extensiveness of the violation here that would want reassurance that the judge took that into account. I don't even know, I'll be honest with you, if I was Judge Miller and I got something back from the commission, if you didn't consider extensiveness here, you look at that photo, and two of my colleagues have heard me on this point, going to get around to everybody, and so I've asked you to reconsider. You look at that photo, and you see two, you know, big individuals in this opening, and you know behind them you see the air, you know this drop off of 120 feet. What is it about extensiveness that would come into play here? I mean, one truck could clearly go through that gap on the photo. Now, okay, isn't that enough? I mean, what could there be more to say about extensiveness? Well, it wasn't that extensive. It wouldn't have two trucks go over the same. I mean, it starts to be, you know, when you consider it, I think that's the danger of sort of saying we, you know, we must have some, you know, discussion of each factor here. So I with respect, I might ask you to rethink about that.
I don't think I'll rethink. With respect to the extensiveness of the violation here, we have to remember that this is 1605L, which is a requirement. It requires or other similar means, which includes the spot. So, notwithstanding the gap that you see in the photograph, it did not require the operator to provide a burn, as long as the operator. And that's where we get to an analysis of the operator's conduct. And so this communication is being able to deal with the finding of the first one. serious violation. So, on the other aspect of it, I'm not trying to straitjacket our judges, but we have, as recently as several months ago, told the judge that he or she had to go through a list of factors that were set forth in consolidation call, and I think there's plenty of commission precedent for admonishing judges to go through that kind of analysis. But we've always said that something I said this morning, that some of those factors may be more important given the circumstances of a given violation than others, and some may not be relevant at all. The point was that the judge needs to go through all that and at least acknowledge that she has, that we have, considered each one, and we're ultimately arriving at a decision or a conclusion as to whether or not the violation is in order. So that's all I'm asking for. We ask for the facts. What we ask for the conclusion.
Are there any other comments or clarifications from any of my colleagues? And then I'll ask Rory. Rory, do you need any clarification on anything at this point on sort of where people have voted on anything, or do you need any on the issues that needed to be covered here? Have we skipped anything, or has anybody skipped anything? I know we had several matters that we were touching on. So
I believe all the issues have been covered. I'm sure that in the upcoming weeks, I will speak to the commissioners and their council and ask for some clarity as I write the decision. But I think as of this time, I'm well situated.
Thank you. Yes, and I think I, and on behalf of all my colleagues, too, would say to feel free to, discuss anything with us on the case.
Chairman, I'm not sure where we're at on the first violation. I think if we all hold the position being stated here, there's clear majorities on each of the issues. On the others, but on the first violation, my count was right. It was a 3-2 vote that it was a roadway. But then, when we get to whether there was a violation, two of us, Commissioner Nakamura and myself, suggested that we should remand. Two commissioners, Mr. Young and Commissioner Duffy, said because there's no roadway, we reverse. And the chairman would affirm. So I'm not sure where the majority lies on that issue of what to do with the fact of the violation. I don't know if that's something we discuss here or we should, mull it over after the meeting.
Yeah, we may require some, we may want to mull it over more after the meeting and consultation with OGC.
Madam Chairman, I would suggest that that's probably the best path to follow. Because I'm not sure that you're going to be able to resolve much more today on the first issue.
That's fine. I just want to flag.
I think you accurately stated.
Yeah, I think you did. It's good that you flagged it, because we do need to now always give some thought to that, and OGC particularly figure it out. Okay, thank you again, Rory, and OGC, and we will go off the record. Thank you. Oh,